Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Healthcare is taking up all of the oxygen in Washington and taking up about 17% of the economy. Barack Obama is trying to resuscitate his health reform bill, and the latest strategy is to turn it from a debate about medicine to a debate about price. This morning, the administration fires another barrage at insurance companies and their rising prices. What they don't know is whether the reaction to the latest outrage over price will sound like this or like this. One final bid to get health reform passed on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 18th. I'm Todd Zwillick here for John Hockenberry this week. And of course, I'm with Celeste. You know, Celeste, the takeaway for me is that the first selling point on health reform was about reining in the insurance companies. Then it was about getting everyone insured. Now it's down to price. And that may be strike three for the administration.
Or it could be a sign that we're actually near to closing the deal.
Maybe.
Now let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. On the first anniversary of the stimulus package yesterday, President Obama said he doesn't want to think about where we'd be without it.
1 year later, it is largely thanks to the Recovery Act that a second depression is no longer a possibility.
Today, the president will sign an executive order to set up a bipartisan commission aimed at reining in the federal deficit. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting the president's also close to reaching a deal with Congress that would create an early warning system for the nation's financial industry. Meanwhile, keeping with this morning's spirit of bipartisanship, House Republicans and Democrats are expected to announce today they'll team up to rewrite the No Child Left Behind law.
If there is a bipartisan spirit, it could be crucial as the economic problems continue to mount up. A Pew Center survey out today shows states may be forced to reduce deficit or raise taxes or slash services because of a $1 trillion shortfall in government pension plans. We're also learning this morning of potential health care premium spikes in several states across the country. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says some insurance companies plan to raise their premium rates anywhere between 20 and 56% in six states. President Obama is expected to seize on these increases to reinforce his case for a health overhaul. We're joined now by John Brown. He's vice president of Brown Furniture Company. It's a small business. The Obama administration is now saying that the debate is all about price. So, John, does this resonate with you and your furniture business? If the debate was about price and your premiums, would you be on board with health reform?
Absolutely. Pricing has been out of control for a long time. Control price, and you have my support.
Your support. What have happened to your premiums in the last, let's say, year or two?
Well, personally, my premium, I just got the letter this month. My premiums are going up about 11% this year, which is not out of the ordinary. Every year it goes up. Every 5 years it goes up about 30%. My employee last year, his insurance premium went up 28%. And then we had to, of course, play the insurance game where you apply and apply and wait and wait.
And those numbers are well multiples of national health inflation rate itself. John Brown, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
8 of the 10 American missionaries arrested in Haiti are waking up this morning in Miami. They were freed yesterday by a Haitian judge, and it was the best day ever for Americans at the Winter Olympics. 6 medals, including 3 gold. That was Shaun White in snowboarding, Lindsey Vonn in the women's downhill, and Shani Davis in speed skating.
Let's look at the markets now. Asian markets are mixed. European markets are up, and futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,309, the S&P opens at 1,099, and the NASDAQ opens at 2266. Coming up, we go to space with astronaut Buzz Aldrin. It's been 80 years since Pluto was discovered, but that doesn't mean we should love it any less. Buzz Aldrin joins us later this hour. We'll also be talking about some programs to help kids graduate early so they can go to college. But do you think you were in high school for too long? Were you ready for work life at age 16? What about the 11th graders that you know? Tell us at 8778-MYTAKER. Post to the website at thetakeaway.org. We'll talk more about it in about a half an hour.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick is here with me this morning. He's filling in for John Hockenberry all this week. And, you know, in the continuing saga of healthcare reform in Washington, in our latest episode, Anthem Blue Cross had raised its rates as much as 39% across the state of California. This caused consternation on the Hills, in Capitol Hill, you know, and President Obama especially, very angry with Anthem Blue Cross for raising their rates of almost 40%. That's because Anthem Blue Cross reported huge earnings for last year. So why do they need to raise their rates so much?
So you're right, Celeste. It is the next chapter in the health reform soap opera. And in this chapter, Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius is releasing a report just moments ago this morning that critiques what the report calls a broken health insurance industry, solely focused now on the bottom line at health insurance companies. Now, we got a sneak peek at this report last night, and we've posted a copy of it on our website at thetakeaway.org. And here's some headlines from the announcement that the secretary will be making later this morning. The bottom line, according to the administration, is that Anthem Blue Cross, that you just mentioned in your chapter there, is not alone. So here are some of the numbers. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Maine is trying to raise its premiums for people buying insurance on the individual market now by 23%.
Individual, that means not their business. Their company's not buying it for them.
Well, if it's a small business, it might be, but not a large employer. This is anyone under probably 15 employees. You might shop for it yourself. If you have 7 employees, you probably buy individual insurance for them, and it's always more expensive. And these are the people that health reform is supposed to be helping. So meanwhile, over in Michigan, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan requested a 56% hike in premiums for those same individual plans. Increases in other states include 20% at Regency Blue Cross Blue Shield in Oregon, up to 16% in Rhode Island, and as high as 40% for some plans in Washington State. This is all according to the Obama administration this morning. So, of course, this report does not come in a vacuum. Democrats, Celeste, as you know, they have a health reform effort in Washington that's stalled. And this report is sort of the latest attempt to refocus the debate and refocus it now directly on people's wallets and their checkbooks.
Well, you know, the question for me was, are these all justified? I mean, is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan losing money by the rate of 56%?
Well, they're not losing money, but they say that this isn't all about profit. We did get a chance to get some response from the insurance industry. The Takeaway spoke with Brad Flugel. He's executive vice president of WellPoint, the parent company of 14 Blue Cross Blue Shield plans across the country, including California's Anthem Blue Cross. Now, here's what Flugel had to say about the company's profits.
Our overall profit margin as a company is around 3 or 4%, which is much less than other sectors of the healthcare industry. So it's not really our profits that are driving these increases, nor is it our administration.
Now, Flugel says skyrocketing premiums are an inevitable consequence of the faltering economy, not just profit-taking.
Unfortunately, with the economic issues that are going on, people are making decisions about whether to continue to stay with their individual health insurance policy. What we're finding is that those that tend to be of better health and younger are the ones who are first dropping their coverage, which means that the remaining people that are insured just have a higher average cost because you don't have the healthier folks that tend to use less services helping to balance out the risk pool.
Now, one of the people on the ground who's really being affected by this, we're joined again by John Brown. He's a small business owner from Oklahoma. He has a furniture business. You heard from him just a couple of minutes ago, who said that his premiums and his employees' premiums going up between 11 and, John Brown, I think you said 26%. Meanwhile, national health insurance inflation, I think, is around 6%. So you're really getting hit.
I think inflation rates are a lot lower than that. I think these increases are 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation, even at 10%. And last year, my employees' insurance went up 28%. Mine just went up 10% this year, which happens every year. Every 5 years, in 2007, my insurance went up 30% in a 15-month period. That's about 2% a month, which is about the rate of inflation for the year in 2007. This is not new. This is not something that's just happening this year. This happens every year.
Every year. And undoubtedly, I don't even need to ask you, undoubtedly hurts your ability to do business and certainly to support your employees. Well, John Brown, let me ask you, when you hear insurance executives or spokespeople say this isn't about profit, this is just, you know, they're victims of a bad economy like everyone else. Do you buy it?
I don't buy it because I have the proof. I have the documentation from every year since I was 25 years old. I've had the same insurance every year. I have the same letters. Like I said, in 2007, when I turned 40 and my wife turned 40, our insurance went up 30% on an individual policy. And 10% may not sound like a lot, but the bigger the premium, obviously, the more money 10% is. This year, my insurance will go up $720 this year. What does that buy? Well, it buys a lot of things.
Buys a lot of things. Well, to put it in some in a national perspective, I think healthcare spending this year is going to be something like $2.2 trillion. We had a brief chat with Robert Zirkelbeck. He's a spokesman for America's Health Insurance Plans. Now, they're the most powerful K Street lobbying firm for the health insurance industry. Listen to what he had to say about the industry and this amount of money that's changing hands.
To put these numbers in perspective, for every dollar that our nation spends on healthcare, less than one penny goes towards health plan profits.
John Brown, less than 1% goes towards health plan profits, he says. They say they're not gouging.
I can easily reduce my profits at Brown Furniture Company. I can just pay myself more money. The profit is not the fact. It's not the point. It's the efficiency of what they're running, how they're running this business. Somebody's making money, and it's certainly not me.
Now, what they say is that the overall cost of providing healthcare services is going up so fast that they have no choice but to raise prices. I guess that would be the equivalent of, in your furniture business, if the price of wood, the price of materials were somehow had a 10% inflation rate, you'd have no choice but to raise prices.
The problem is, people do not have to buy new furniture. People have to buy health insurance to protect their family.
Good point.
We're the victims here. We can't do anything but pay their premiums, because if we don't, then we have to go insurance shopping, run the risk of losing insurance. Everybody's got pre-existing conditions. How do you do it? How do you deal with it?
John Brown, small business owner from Oklahoma, owns his own furniture business. Health insurance premiums for his workers up as much as 28% in the last year, and I think as much as 30 or 35% over the last 5 years. This all amid a report from the Obama administration that individual insurance premiums being hiked as much as 40% in individual states as the health reform debate heats up again in Washington. Mr. Brown, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's check in now on some of the top stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
Eight of the American missionaries charged with child kidnapping in Haiti have been released. They arrived in Miami early this morning. Two of the missionaries are still detained. The judge plans to question them today. Also in Haiti, U.S. Commander Lieutenant General Ken Keene says the U.S. hospital ship Comfort is emptying out.
We were able to locate places within Haiti medical facilities to place patients that have been treated initially on the Comfort to other locations.
Right now, Haitians are anxiously awaiting an announcement from the government about housing plans for the homeless. At home, mortgage relief not arriving fast enough for distressed homeowners. As of last month, only about 100,000 people had received loan modifications. That's compared with nearly 1 million who have attempted to modify their mortgage terms. Those figures come from the Treasury Department.
We're just learning that the top United Nations official in charge of climate change negotiations has announced his resignation. Yves Deboer's resignation follows the failure of the climate change conference in Copenhagen last December. Here, former President Bill Clinton is recovering from last week's heart procedure. He says he has some new priorities.
I intend to continue to work as hard as I can, but I am going to manage the stress better. Sleep more, fewer overnight flights, be more disciplined about taking some exercise every day.
Good advice, Mr. President. Finally, in sports, Tiger Woods will speak publicly for the first time tomorrow. Since his sex scandal broke on Thanksgiving, he won't take any questions from reporters, but he is expected to apologize. And that's a look at some of the top stories we're watching this morning.
Coming up, President Obama will create a bipartisan commission to examine ways to reduce federal debt. But in a bitterly divided Congress, is this really going to work? We're going to talk about it in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Some takeouts now on the stories we're following this week. 6 medals yesterday for the United States at the Winter Olympics, including 3 gold. This is what the takeaway control room this morning is calling best Olympics day ever. Here are some highlights. Lindsey Vonn shook off a shin injury. She won the gold medal in the women's downhill. The United States also took the silver in that. The snowboarding half pipe went to American Sean White. And sports writer Dan Friedel joining us from Vancouver. How about Shani Davis in the 1,000 speed skate?
Yeah, that was quite a performance. Shani Davis hasn't lost at that distance this year, so he was the odds-on favorite, and he came through. He was one of the last skaters to go in the competition, and it's the kind of competition where you get one shot. You know, there's no second chance, and he pulled it off. He had a great skate and added to the record haul for the day and a gold medal. And his teammate Chad Hedrick was up there on the leaderboard as well, and he got the bronze.
And we should also add that in the women's downhill, it wasn't just Lindsey Vonn who took the women's downhill. Julia Mancuso with the silver. So some big medal performances for the United States. And everyone now is looking forward to men's figure skating tonight. What are we looking out for?
Well, I mean, we'll be looking at the free skate, and that's the thing that's left up to the judges' interpretation. The skaters have a chance to show their artistry in a way that's not quite as evident in the short program. The free skate allows them to show off their interpretive ability a little bit more, and also their athleticism. You have to remember that they're out there on the ice skating for 3 or 4 minutes and doing these jumps, and they've got to land perfectly. And it's an athletic competition for sure. The favorite looks like it's going to be Russian Evgeny Plushenko.
Right.
And you know, the hometown favorite, Patrick Chan, is going to have to put in a great skate for Canada to get himself into medal contention. And the American certainly can look out for Evan Lysacek, the defending world champion, and Johnny Weir for good performances. So it should be exciting. It'll definitely be something to watch.
Johnny Weir, always controversial. Looking forward to the skating tonight. Freelance sports writer Dan Friedel joining us from Vancouver. Thank you.
Another takeout from our rough economic times today. The New York Times reports a growing number of companies have been passing regular employees off as independent contractors, and federal and state officials say no more. Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Louise, why are state and federal officials worried about whether or not an employee is a private contractor or full-time employee?
We're talking about some big numbers here, Celeste. The Labor Department estimates that about 30% of all companies are passing people off as independent contractors when they're really just the same as regular workers. The reason companies would do this is, if it's a contractor, you don't have to pay Social Security, Medicare, unemployment taxes, and you also leave income taxes up to the worker, and, not all workers are going to report their income.
So The state is obviously losing out on tax income, but are the companies saving money by claiming that they're private contractors?
Yes, because they're not paying the Medicare and the Social Security taxes. President Obama put this in his 2010 budget, and he estimates that by cracking down on this practice, that will pull in $7 billion over 10 years. So we're talking billion. That's right. So we're talking about big numbers that the government can really use at this time. And the other thing to keep in mind is, a lot of workers may be afraid to say something to their companies about this. When they're considered contractors, they lose their basic rights, such as anti-discrimination rights, rights to overtime payment, minimum wage. So this is also about treating workers fairly.
That's right. Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
Now, yesterday, Louise joined us, and she was looking at our soaring federal deficit and why it's gotten so high. President Obama wanted to set up a bipartisan fiscal commission, Republicans and Democrats from members of Congress, to try to rein in the federal deficit. He was blocked by that effort from Congress, and here's what the president had to say after he was blocked.
I've proposed a bipartisan fiscal commission to provide recommendations for long-term deficit reduction. Because in the end, solving our fiscal challenge, so many years in the making, will take both parties coming together, putting politics aside.
And that didn't happen. So the president said he's going to sign an executive order and set up his own commission. And that commission is getting ready to get going. Joining us is Walter Alarcon. He's my colleague on The Hill and staff writer for The Hill newspaper. Good morning, Walter.
Morning, Todd.
So, Walter, the president said he'll set up his own debt commission if Congress won't help him. But Republicans so far have not been too interested in joining. Is this going to be a bipartisan effort?
Well, the president
at the very least, is going to get Republicans who are out of office. The co-chairman of this commission is going to be Alan Simpson, the former senator from Wyoming, who was Bob Dole's deputy in the mid-90s. And then he's going to be working with Erskine Bowles, who was Bill Clinton's chief of staff, around the same time. Now, that sort of says something, the fact that the president has to go back toward the 90s, the early 90s, a different political time, to try to find people to work together on this deficit commission. Sort of speaks to the difficulties here. We don't see a lot of Republicans right now in Congress want to come to the table. They're saying that this is just a stalking horse for tax increases. Democratic leaders are a little bit more open to it in Congress, but on the left side of the party, the unions, and also the AARP, the lobbying group for seniors, they're a bit concerned that this is just going to lead to perhaps entitlement cuts, spending decreases, stuff that the Democrats right now conceivably might be able to get done if they could corral all these votes that they have large majorities.
All those things are politically difficult, but things that have to be done to rein in the deficit. Walter Alarcon, what does it say about Washington right now that to make any of the tough choices, no one of import who makes a decision is willing to come to the table?
Well, you know, it really speaks to how difficult it is to get done. We see these midterms coming up. The Republicans don't want to give the president any advantage. And this, you know, here the president is reaching his hand out, and Republicans have to make a decision. Do they want to join up here?
Well, they might sense it. They might sense a trap as well. Walter Alarcon, staff writer for The Hill newspaper, joining us to talk about the president's bipartisan debt commission. Thanks for joining us.
A trap?
A trap?
Good morning. Coming up, most of us probably felt like we spent too many years in high school, but were we really ready to go to college at age 15 or 16? That's the question we're asking listeners today at 877-8-MY-TAKE, but we're going to talk about this in just a few moments. First, though, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A controversial visit to the White House this morning. That's the sound of children welcoming the Dalai Lama to Washington. The exiled Tibetan spiritual leader will meet with President Obama at the White House, despite strong protests from China. And also today, the president will sign an executive order to set up a bipartisan commission aimed at reining in the federal deficit. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting the president is close to reaching a deal with Congress that would create an early warning system for the nation's financial industry.
Overseas, fighting is intensifying in parts of the Afghan town of Marja this morning, where U.S. Marines have come under attack by insurgents with rocket-propelled grenades. This comes even though U.S. officials say the town is safe enough for Afghan officials to begin setting up a city government. Also in Afghanistan, we're learning this morning of the arrest of two Taliban officials. One of the arrests was the result of information gleaned from captured Taliban operations chief Mullah Abdul Baradar, and officials in Pakistan say up to 9 militants with links to al-Qaeda have been arrested. Back at home, 8 American missionaries charged with child kidnapping in Haiti are back in the U.S. The group flew into Miami early this morning after a judge in Haiti allowed them to leave. 2 members of the group are still being detained in Haiti, and a judge there plans to question them today. And also today in Haiti, the government's expected to announce its plans for sheltering over 1 million people left homeless by last month's earthquake. 2009 saw the second lowest number of plane crashes ever. An airline industry group says there were only 18 fatal crashes last year, but nearly 200 more deaths compared to the year before. Let's check in on the markets now. Asian markets are mixed. European markets are up and futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,309. The S&P opens at 1,099. And the NASDAQ opens at 2216 this morning. Those are some of the stories we're following.
School actually could be out sooner for some high school students in some states than we're used to. Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Kentucky. All of those states are planning to introduce a new program that will allow 10th graders to graduate early and go on to community college. And in Utah, they're considering a proposal right now that would eliminate the senior year altogether. What's going on in our school systems? We're going to ask our next guest that. He's Terry Holliday. He's the Kentucky's Education Commissioner, and he's currently trying to recruit 10 to 20 high schools in his state to start this program of allowing 10th graders to graduate early and go to college. Terry, are you having trouble recruiting students?
Oh, well, we're just beginning. We'll have a meeting in April to begin recruiting the districts, but we have a lot of districts that have expressed interest so far. I don't think we'll have a problem getting 10 to 20 high schools to implement this type of program.
I see that you've called this program the Move On When Ready program, and I have to be a little bit skeptical about that. Are 15-year-olds ready to move on to college?
Well, I've had an experience came from North Carolina, where we had in place programs called Early College and Middle College, and certainly these students have been able to move on and gather college credits. But I think the key thing is making sure that all of our students are college ready. I think that's what this program focuses on first, making sure we put the standards out there and show the students how they should prepare to be college ready, because right now half the students in the nation that go on to college have to take remediation courses.
Well, is this about budget cuts? Are you trying to save money by sending kids out of school early?
No, in actuality, the long run, it may have some cost savings, but on the front end, it may have a little bit more cost. We're not trying to push kids out. We're trying to allow them early graduation types of options. We've had students that have had interest like this for years, but this would enable gifted students who are ready to move on to do so, and also enable students who oftentimes drop out because they're just bored with high school some choices. I think this is more about choice for parents and students than trying to push students somewhere they don't want to go.
Well, let's go to talk to a teacher now. Lauren Carbonell is a high school teacher at Quinebaug Valley Middle College High School in Danielson, Connecticut. Connecticut is one of the states that's also ready to implement this change in their high school system. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning.
You actually work in a school that's been allowing students to take community college courses for the past 2 years. But, you know, taking courses at a community college, which I did when I was in high school, is vastly different than going to college as a 15-year-old.
It is. I would say I think that there's a little bit more support as far as from parents, and our high school itself actually provides support for a lot of the students that do take community college classes.
So they're still in high school and taking community college courses. You heard us talking just a moment about people who are choosing students who are college ready, but the school examines whether they're intellectually or academically ready for college. And really, I would imagine the biggest problem is maturity level. You get to college and you're dealing with issues involved in sex. You're dealing with drinking issues. Often there's drug issues on a college campus. I can't imagine a 15 or 16-year-old is ready for that.
Well, I would say that in a community college versus like a boarding school, I would say that it's more likely for a student to get in trouble as far as like drinking and sex. In a boarding school, I know that when I started college at age 17, I probably spent the first year partying too much. But I think that in a community college, when you are commuting, there's less of that partying going on, and I think it enables kids to become more mature. So I would actually advocate that students who are going to community colleges at an early age are actually going to be positively influenced by some of the older students. As far as my classes that I teach, I actually teach after school at the community college as well, and I have students who are up to age 50, 55 or so. I think that actually they have a positive influence on some of my high school students that are taking the college class.
Terry Holliday, Kentucky's Education Commissioner, what is your response to that? Are students already having to deal with these issues of sex and drinking and possibly drugs in high school, so the maturity level is not as huge of an issue when they go to community college?
Absolutely, and I think what Lauren's talking about is what we'll be working through. The issues in this program is the wraparound services students need, so the transition is smooth and they have the support that they need. We're not talking about just throwing them on a boarding school campus. We're talking about open enrollment, community colleges, and creating conditions for their success through a partnership with the community colleges. This is happening all over the nation, and this program just allows us to make sure that we're getting the kids ready academically and to some degree emotionally for the challenges. But it'll be a choice program. No one would be forced into it.
You know, Terry, I can't help but have doubts when we see these issues with college students in their first 2 years getting an enormous numbers of credit card debt. That's not saying that a 15-year-old can get a credit card, but I'm just talking about levels of maturity and the trouble a kid can get into college when they start stepping out on their own. In Texas, they're looking at extending the school year because they feel that students aren't getting as much class time as they need to. I know that you say this is about choice and allowing people to go to college, but shouldn't we be taking a look at whether or not, if kids are getting to college and still needing remedial classes, shouldn't they need more class time?
Well, we think that what this program will do will help the children be better prepared for college. And again, we have many examples of this type of program already all over the nation. Students end up with as many as 60 to 80 credit hours for college and save parents a lot of money and colleges a lot of money.
Okay, Terry Holliday is the Education Commissioner in Kentucky. We also talked to Lauren Carbonell, a high school teacher at Quinebaug Valley Middle College High School in Danielson, Connecticut. Coming up, Pluto, not a planet anymore, sadly, but it still deserves some love from the blue planet. We're going to talk to astronaut Buzz Aldrin about this on the 80th anniversary of Pluto's discovery.
Who says it's not a planet?
Everybody. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. We spoke earlier this morning with Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez about the prevalence of sexual assault in the U.S. military, and the Congresswoman is not satisfied with how accepted it is.
We have a policy, and we've had it for several years now, that women must go in the buddy system to the restroom. Most women will not go to the restroom at night because that's when most of the attacks are happening, for example.
You can hear that full interview at thetakeaway.org. And, you know, that's about sexual assault in the military, but worldwide there are still questions about whether or not women should be serving in the front lines at all. Joining us now is Nuala McGovern. She's the host of the BBC's call-in show, World Have Your Say. And they're taking a global look at the issue of women serving in the military. Nuala, you had two women on your program with two very different perspectives. First, let's hear a little bit from Catherine Ross. She's a former soldier in the U.S. Army.
The reality on the ground does not match the policy. The reality is that we find ourselves serving with ground combat units at battalion level and below every day in Iraq. I mean, I'm not the only one who's done it. There are many other females who have done it. So, you know, there are women who are capable of serving in combat arms units, and they should be afforded that opportunity if they want it.
Did you hear from listeners who talked about women actually serving in frontline combat units?
Yes, we did indeed, Celeste. And I think it really was, you know, fairly split down the middle, their opinion. I brought in a couple of comments of a couple of people who agreed with Catherine. David in the UK, he wrote on the World Have Your Say blog that Russia used women extensively during World War II, and a lot of Britain's women went into occupied France as agents. And women are doing just fine in Iraq and Afghanistan. If they want to serve their country as combatants, I'll be the first to salute them. Sherry took a different point. Hers was, if women can deliver a 14-pound baby, then they can handle anything. I mean, one thing that was quite interesting about Catherine Ross, who was featured in the New York Times blog, The Opinionator, her husband is actually in active duty, and he does not agree with it. He does not think women should serve on the front line.
He's a little biased, though. You also talked to Judy Webb. She's the first female officer to command an all-male squadron in the United Kingdom. Here's what she had to say.
I do not think that there is a role for women in the infantry. I just feel that our physical differences are such that very few women want to achieve those sort of physical levels. And I think, to the detriment of the armed services generally, it reduces the standards of an infantry soldier's fitness. And I don't think that's acceptable.
Did you find that this is what things kind of hinged on, that women are not as physically capable of it as men?
Well, it was really interesting. That's where our conversation began. But that was really only just one part of it. Other arguments, which I found really interesting, one was the distraction factor. And really that moved from everything from men behaving differently when there's a woman around to taking maybe more risks if they were in the front line with a female colleague. And there was also the issue of troop morale. And apparently, according to some people, it really affects a platoon much more significantly when a female colleague is killed rather than a male colleague, which I thought were another three of the arguments.
Was it mostly women that were supporting the right to be in combat units?
Excuse me, Celeste?
Was it mostly women who said that women should be able to fight?
No, it was totally split down the middle. We had a number of people that agreed or disagreed. Lance emailed. He said, when the hand-to-hand combat begins and women are taken prisoners and sexually violated, what do we say then? Echo Rose in Florida says, if a woman can carry her weight, let her do it.
Okay, Nuala McGovern, host of the last night's BBC call-in show, World Have Your Say.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillig, in for John Hockenberry this week, and here with Celeste Headlee. Well, here's a little planetary poem. Celeste, are you ready?
You're going to read this poem?
I am. I feel as though I have to. Here it is.
Okay.
Pluto, Pluto in the sky, you're not a planet, but we love you. Why? We have to thank for that. Who else? Takeaway producer Leo Duran in the control room, apparently with too much time on his hands, he's writing verse. But we get to the answer to that question in just a minute from astronaut Buzz Aldrin and astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson on the 80th anniversary of Pluto's discovery. They're joining us in just a few moments, but right now here's a check on some stories we're following at 47 minutes past the hour. The AP says as many as 9 militants linked to Al-Qaeda have been arrested in the Pakistani city of Karachi. Earlier this week, it was revealed that the second in command of the Afghan Taliban has been interrogated after being detained in the same city.
Yesterday was the best day ever for Americans in the history of the Winter Olympics. The U.S. took 6 medals, including 3 golds in Vancouver. One of those was a win by alpine skier Lindsey Vonn. She says it was a thrilling victory.
When I crossed the finish line, seeing my name up there, number one, was overwhelming. You know, it was the best feeling of my life, and I've been crying for a long time, and you know, just seeing my family here was overwhelming.
The U.S. also took gold in men's snowboarding and men's speed skating. At home, National Guard soldiers who served deployments overseas may finally receive checks for paid leave. The Army says nearly 7,000 soldiers are in line to receive the checks, which are 3 years late. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
80 years ago, an astronomer named Clyde Tombaugh, who worked at the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, made a discovery that would capture the imagination of space enthusiasts for generations, including this kid. Tombaugh discovered Pluto. In honor of that discovery, we have two guests who've had a hand in how we think and dream about space, and certainly about what some people call the dwarf planet. I'm joined by Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an astrophysicist and author and host of Novus Science Now. And get this, astronaut Buzz Aldrin, Apollo 11 moonwalker. It's an honor to have you both on the show.
Happy to be here.
Hey, good morning, Neil.
Good morning, Buzz. How the hell are you, man?
Professor Tyson, let me start with you about Pluto. Now, of course, we've had the long-running debate about whether Pluto is a planet or not. And to Pluto planet lovers, I got to say, you're one of the villains. You've referred to Pluto as a dwarf planet. You've referred to it noncommittally as a cosmic object. Where are we in our thinking about Pluto and its membership in the solar system?
Don't shoot the messenger.
Right.
All I did was reveal to the world with a group of my colleagues back in New York. In fact, it was almost exactly 10 years ago. We opened the new Rose Center for Earth and Space, the then new facility. And when you have a new facility, it gives you an occasion to rethink the trend lines in scientific discovery and how you might create an exhibit. So we put up an exhibit upon realizing that there's some other icy, small, weird orbited objects in the outer solar system. We decided to group Pluto among them. This is now known as the Kuiper Belt of icy objects. And that's really all we did. We didn't kick Pluto out of the solar system, but we were the first to do this publicly. And there had been a debate sort of percolating behind the scenes, and it finally hit ahead in 2006 when the international community of astronomers voted to formally demote Pluto or reclassify it to dwarf planet status. And this pissed off a lot of people.
Sure. And to so many people, it was sort of kicking it out of the solar system because all of us had learned, of course, 9 planets and Pluto is the smallest of them all. And it's kind of the darling. Have you discovered that? I know you have your new show, The Pluto Files, which is coming up next month. You're kind of touring the country talking about Pluto.
Yeah, so the book that I wrote, The Pluto Files, was really a catharsis for me because I was branded as public enemy for having revealed this information about Pluto. And so in the Pluto Files, it shares with the viewer, the reader in the case of the book, but the special coming up on March 2nd, actually, it's kids, third graders, sending me hate mail. A lot of it is entertaining, and it's all in fun, but it revealed something about the power of this particular cosmic object in the hearts and minds of Americans. And,
you still can't say the P word, can you? You just can't say it. You can't say it. Buzz Aldrin, let me ask you if I could, you know, traveling to Pluto, the dream of that, far from it. The latest budget from the Obama administration, as I know you know, zeroes out the Constellation program. That is putting a major impediment on man's scheduled return to the moon, on manned spaceflight. How do you view where we're at in terms of promoting manned spaceflight right now?
Well, Neil is a troublemaker about Pluto, and I grew up with Pluto, a Disney character, and wondering what Pluto the dog was doing way out there. But I'm kind of a troublemaker right now, because we need to do some things that interject a changeover from government launch humans into low Earth orbit to commercial launching. Of humans into, and that's a pet project of mine, because we've been landing people for 30 years with the space shuttle, and it wasn't a mistake. It was a very big, technically complex vehicle, but to follow that by landing back in the ocean again is just not what we ought to be doing. Yeah, that's why I've been behind a lifting body runway lander. As soon as we can get it done on a very reliable Atlas V launch vehicle.
On an Atlas V rocket.
And at the same time, do all we can to close the gap so that we don't have to buy rides to our space station from the Russians.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, either way, manned spaceflight is going to be slowed down with the budget cuts that we've had, whether it's to the moon or beyond, and whether it's on an Atlas rocket or a Constellation launch vehicle.
I've never been strongly opinionated about one species of launch vehicle or another.
Right.
I know Buzz has been. But what Buzz has gotten right from the very beginning is the fact that you don't have a sustained presence in space unless a space program morphs into a space industry. And without the commercial support for what we all hope to be a sustained presence in space, then NASA has to, you know, go hat in hand to Congress every year. And so one of the sort of silver linings of this, of these new decisions regarding NASA in the Obama administration is the tacit statement that they want NASA to sort of get out of the low Earth orbit business and cede that over to commercial enterprise. And that's a very natural trajectory that the government has taken in the past. The government historically has made the initial investments in industries or activities that for which the capital markets couldn't value until it was established, and then the capital markets swoop in and it creates thriving tax base for the country.
And in the meantime, Neil deGrasse Tyson, before we sort out how to get high Earth orbit manned launch either to the moon or beyond, we're going to have to be satisfied probably with what we have, which is Hubble photos. I've been pretty impressed. Well, I'm a huge fan of Hubble deep field photos, but we've got some new photos of, well, I'm going to call it a planet. You can call it what you want, but we've got some new Hubble photos of Pluto.
Yeah, so Hubble, you know, Hubble is a great substitute for going there. you zoom in and see what you've got. And the latest images from Pluto, normally we associate Hubble with deep field objects across the universe, but it can look at relatively nearby objects as well. And these recent objects, images of Pluto, show that the surface is actually quite interesting, highly varied in reflectivity, and even some sort of amber color that's there. It's a little bit mysterious. But there's a mission headed there right now, the New Horizons mission, in the fast lane. It'll get there in about 5 years, and it'll get the first very close-up images of Pluto from a flyby. But images of distant objects versus traveling there, these are two different kinds of enterprises. And, you know, Buzz is a hero because he went to a new cosmic object. And as a culture, we value our explorers in ways that few other people in society are valued. We build statues to explorers. We write books and stories and novels about them. And so to remove that as sort of the dream that so many of us maybe even took for granted growing up in the 60s and early 70s, I think it undersells who and what we can be as a nation.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist and author and host of Nova Science Now. And Buzz Aldrin, retired astronaut, joins us to give us their vision of the future of space. Thank you both for joining us. You know, I'm with two skinny J's on this. When I say Pluto, you say Pluto.
If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Check our podcast. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org. You know, earlier we talked about programs to help kids graduate early so they can go to college, and we've already been hearing your stories.
This is Lisa Cahill calling from Rhode Island. And my son, who started off the school year as a senior, 16-year-old, is participating in Rhode Island's Running Start program. And he's taking all of his senior courses at the community college, and it's been a great transition because I know next year when he goes away to college, he'll have to have already had that experience of getting himself up in the morning and going to class and knowing the rigors of college. So go for it.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.